Hello and welcome to the Trailing Blazers podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Block Talk Radio, whatever you're looking for in your podcast needs, we've got you covered. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, and this time here with me, Mr. Taylor Danforth. Taylor, how
in
you doing, buddy?
Person, Dan, I get to look you straight in the eyes. Just look in those big, beautiful eyes of yours while we do this show.
We're kind of flashing back to the old studio days, and you know, it's one of those things where you don't have to get that awkward pause. You can look into the eyes and see there's something brewing.
What about the awkward pause?
Oh, okay. Right about that. Oh, thank God it's not live radio. All right, well, we're in a pretty decent mood now because the Blazers, contrary to my belief, managed to pull a game out on the road trip. That game against the Boston Celtics was the last one that I thought they'd win, but they come home instead of going 0-for, going 1-for-3. What's your overall take on the road trip?
Amazing what happens and how you feel. I forgot what it was like to win. It's amazing what happens and how you feel as a fan when you have an entertaining game like we did against the Celtics and they win. Oh, we did our bold predictions and half joking, half not. Hey, it wouldn't surprise me if they went in and beat the 76ers and then followed that up with a win against the Celtics in back-to-back games. It just seems like something the Blazers would do. And outside of Alan Crabb, for whatever reason, not shooting that last-second shot against Philly, which we can talk about, an amazing performance, really, against the Boston Celtics, and one where, I tweeted this out, I don't understand how you go from getting blown out by the Wizards to taking the third-best team in the East to overtime and winning that game. Thrilled they did. I just miss those moments in this season. We haven't had a lot of them. Two stand out, right? Cleveland and Boston. Outside of that, there haven't been too many of those moments. So just from that standpoint, I was happy that we got to experience a Blazers win against an upper echelon team.
Now, I don't want to say the cliche here, turn the corner, because I don't think that Portland Trail Blazers turned the corner in any way. They had a good performance against Boston. And while I know a lot of people are excited about that and they want to say, hey, back on track, let's build upon this, I'm going to be the pessimist that I always am and say, it's a win. It's good. You know, it's a feel-good win. It's an exceptional performance by CJ, Damian, and Myers. But is it anything more than that?
I don't know, because I've thought that it was the turning point in the season multiple times, and it's never come. I've thought that we've had been at that point. Like, how long have we've had this discussion at least three or four times throughout the season. Like, all right.
Cleveland, Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City was the one earlier in the year where it's like, okay, finally, they got a nice win. Now things are back on track, and we want them to be back on track. They should win against the Lakers on Wednesday. I would imagine that would be a win. And then they've got, you know, they've got a five-game homestand coming up. So I would hope that there is some momentum that can be built. A lot of, you know, some teams struggle as the trade deadline approaches, and then the Blazers, maybe one of those teams. We'll see how guys play with the threat of being traded or not. That's tough on guys of not knowing if you're going to be with this team and where you stand, especially as names started to get floated around. CJ's name has always been a part of trade rumors. It's not going to affect him, but other guys, Myers, Crabb, Aminu could be floated around, Plumlee. I think it'll be interesting to see how those guys play between now and the deadline. But in terms of, is this a turning point? I'd like to say yes. I just haven't seen it enough, and we've had enough of those conversations that it's hard for me to say yes.
And just kind of drop a little teaser here. We've got James Hollis from At B-Ball Breakdown, Almighty Baller Podcast Network, Celtics guru, a.k.a. Tweet Good Mac, a.k.a. Snotty Drippin', the man. He'll be joining us here later.
That's a lot of names.
I know, right? I mean, I hope to someday have like an alias list. Like, it's one of those things where you get checked in and you're like, it's the old joke of, you know, the Ron White stand-up. You know, you got to have one of those aliases that everybody's just kind of like, wait, you did what? But James is the man. He's going to join us here in a little bit, talk some Celtics, talk Blazers, talk outlook for the Portland Trailblazers going through the season, and how things can shape out in the Northwest Division. Now, in the immediate future, Portland's got a nice homestand here. They have five home games in 13 days, and they've got 3 days off to prepare for this. Now, we were talking about this before the show, in that this was the time last year, on the calendar year and in the way the schedule broke out, where they made a turn. Mid-late January, they had those days of practice where they really went after each other. They really got it together on both ends of the floor, and they made that hard push. Now, are we going to see the same thing? Is that same narrative going to carry the day? Later this week, are we going to see news articles coming out from the beat reporters that they really got after it in practice? They really went after it in the film session. They went after each other, you know, in meetings, and this is going to be the building point, or is this going to be something that they don't really, they just kind of gloss over?
This is another thing I'm torn on, because I want the Blazers to get things turned around, and I'd like for them to play well. As a fan, I enjoy watching that. The Boston win, I found frustrating for a couple of reasons. The first one was, I just, where has that been? Was when I watched that game, I was like, this is how they should be playing for the majority of the season. Even going back to the 76ers loss, like, even though they lost that game, they were in it and they were competitive and it was fun to watch. And same thing into Boston. They were competitive and ended up winning that game. So in terms of getting better and improving, I want to see that consistently through. I don't want to be blown out anymore. I'm tired of the blowouts. So I think that the time off and the homestand will help with that and being more competitive. But if they are able to come back and find some sort of magic solution, some sort of solution that works, I just keep asking, where has this been? Why now? I understand why last year it took a while, and last year in the homestand before the All-Star break, they're able to get their defense back and things started to click and gel for them. I would be surprised if it would gel now, and then I would ask, well, why has it taken so long to do that? That being said, I fully expect them to play better these next five games.
This next stretch has some winnable games on. And if Portland's going to get things going, this is where it's got to happen. And to me, when I look at it, this is the make or break portion of the season for which fork in the road they take.
Well, they're just running out of time.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it before. The mathematic possibilities of them being able to get above the 8th seed are slim and none. So if they're going to make that push, it has to happen right now. It's this block of 10 games, if it doesn't happen, it's not going to happen. They're going to fall too far behind. And there's, I think we used up all the goodness of the basketball gods last year in that run to be able to make another historic type of run down the stretch.
Well, don't you just even want to see improvement from guys? Because I think that's enough for me personally to watch the team improve. Winning is the ultimate, and I want to watch them win. But I also want to watch guys get better and the team collectively get better. The last couple of games, watching them has felt like they're improving and gelling as a unit.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it. You got otherworldly performances from Damian and CJ against Boston. And this is a Boston team, it's a good team. But they're missing their best defender in Avery Bradley and a guy who can contribute offensively. And that makes me a little bit wary of where this team is. Yes, it's a win. Yes, they played well. But they needed unbelievable. They got 63 points out of Damian and CJ on 20 of 42 from the floor.
It's pretty good.
I mean, they're both. CJ gets the line 13 times.
Which never happens.
That does not happen. And if that becomes the norm, not 13, just 7 or 8, that's a damn good number.
But they're good for those. I would say Damian and CJ can combine for those one every 6 or 7 games. I don't see any reason why they can't.
No, I mean,
get hot at the same time.
They average 50 a game, but together. I mean, but they never have a game where they're both very efficient from the floor. They both hit threes. They both got to the free throw line. They both hit their shots. I mean, when you give two guys that are giving you 63 points on 42 shots,
yeah, you're winning a lot of ball games.
I mean, they
plus with what Myers did, which we'll talk about.
I mean, 6 of 7 from the floor, 17 points, two absolute hammers.
Just monster dunks.
We'll touch on that here in a little bit, but you needed all of that to beat a Boston team missing Avery Bradley.
Yeah, but it was on the last game of a road trip, a back-to-back, and on the road. So I'll give them credit, even though you're right, Bradley was out, and he gives, I think he's probably the second or third best perimeter defender in the league.
And he gives Dame more fits than anyone not named Chris Paul.
Yeah, I would say Kawhi is probably the best perimeter defender. Chris Paul's up there. And then I'd put Avery Bradley probably third or fourth.
We're talking the same pantheon. I mean, Avery Bradley, because of his size, won't ever be thought of that way. Tony Allen is a much bigger player. Chris Paul is a first ballot Hall of Famer. Kawhi Leonard should be considered as an MVP candidate right now as the second best two-way player in the entire NBA. So when you're talking about that, and that's what kind of makes me leery of heaping too much praise. Yes, you're right. On a back-to-back, last game of a road trip, you've You lost a close one in Philly in a game that you, by all rights, you should be winning.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because they haven't had many close situations. You remember last year, and we did this in our last podcast, comparing last year to this year. If you look back at last year, they were in a lot of games close. And they didn't execute down the stretch. And it was a lot of Damian ISO. And the question we asked Stotts after the game is, what's going wrong at the end of games? And he goes, no, those will even themselves out. We'll get it turned around. The Blazers haven't been in many close games this year. So you saw some of that stuff, the rust that you may get off in the beginning of the year and putting guys in that situation. Alan Crabb hasn't really been in that situation much. 4 seconds ever left. And for him to pass it up to Plumlee, Plumlee's just looking at him like, dude, why are you passing it to me?
And credit goes to Plumlee. Yes,
he tried.
But he tried to make...
But he should never be in that position.
No, and he did what I think everybody who's a hardcore fan of the NBA wants somebody to do at the end of the game, which is put the ball on the floor, go to the rim, mm-hmm. see what happens.
He tried.
Yeah.
Missed. I mean, it was a tough shot, but a makeable shot for sure.
And it's one of those things where you would think that, or you would hope that Alan Crabb in that position settles down into that moment. It's probably his first time on the professional level being in that moment. And that's why having guys like Lillard, like McCollum, that are so good in those moments. And everyone wants to say, well, can we get rid of the clutch narrative with Dame? If you look at his clutch stats, according to NBA.com, they're really not great. He's shooting like 35% in the clutch. The entire opponent game plan is targeted around take Damian away.
Oh, I think Damian and CJ are elite clutch players. I think both of those guys are. When you talk about the rest of the league and guys whose you want the ball in their hands, I'd put both of those guys up there.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going to throw names up on the board that you're going to give the ball to make a shot in the last
two minutes, Kyrie's probably one.
You're talking KD, Steph, Kyrie, LeBron. Well, maybe not LeBron, because that debate's always fun. But Dame and CJ are right there in that upper echelon because of their ability to create off the bounce. There's a very limited number of players that from 40 feet and minimal time on the clock can create their own shot, either at the three-point line, mid-range, or getting to the rim, or getting space. They both do it differently in that Dame is better going to the rack, CJ's better at creating that airspace. But they're both entirely capable. I mean, we've seen more and more of it lately from CJ and his ability to hit clutch shot after clutch shot. I mean, he had that one where he missed it wasn't the Magic game, but he had an opportunity in the mid-range and he pulled up and missed. Was that the Wizards game?
No, because they got blown up by the Wizards. I can't remember what they had one. Oh man, I'm blanking on it. He had one where
Dame said that's
Pistons.
A shot you
it was
give.
Detroit,
it was
right?
Detroit.
It was
yep.
Detroit. Yeah.
It was a shot where Dame said he gets that shot. That shot is cash.
Mm-hmm.
You want him taking that shot, and I think that's kind of pays tribute to how good CJ is. That it's hard to remember a time when he's given the ball in a clutch situation and hasn't come up with it.
Yeah, so it's hard to blame Crabb because he's just not in that position a whole lot. It's Damian and it's CJ. You'd still like to hope he learns from it, but you'd still like to, you know, 4 seconds left that you're not passing up to a big and he panicked. But that's a loss that was made a little better from the fact that the 76ers beat the Raptors earlier in the season. Are you doing all right over there?
Yeah, no. It's,
dude,
it's,
it sounds like you broke something.
Yeah, that was me breaking a glass. That's actually pretty
Oh,
impressive.
Was that? Did you break it?
Yeah, pretty sure I did.
Oh, about that. That is fantastic.
Yeah, it's one of those things you get to kind of hopefully you can edit later. Sorry about the loud noises, guys. That's my
No, I don't think we
feel.
Do. I think we leave that in. I think we leave that in and pick right up. Yeah, but Alan Crabb, that's a learning lesson, and it's a learning moment. But that loss, you know, was made a little easier by the fact that they had just lost to the Wizards and the Hornets and then ended up beating Boston. So overall, you'd like to go 2-2 on the road trip. But I'm at the point now, Dan, in the season, and we can talk about this as the podcast progresses here over the next couple of weeks. I am in pure let's improve mode, more so than winning and losing.
And with that in mind, we're going to go ahead and bring in James Hollis now and let him kind of expand on where Portland is, how the NBA is kind of shaken out, and get his feel for the take from the outside of the Portland Magic. And we're glad to have James Hollis here on the Trailing Blazers podcast. You can find him at B-Ball Breakdown. His Twitter handle, at James Hollis. You may know him as the former Snotty Drippin'. You can also find him as another member of the Almighty Baller Podcast Network on the Truth Podcast as a true Celtics fan. James, glad to have you here, man.
Oh, I just want to jump in and say that the Twitter handle that actually at JHollisHoops is what it is.
Oh, but that's right. That's my fault.
Everything else was awesome. Everything else was awesome.
Speaking of awesome, how about that Blazers-Celtics game?
It was fun. It was fun to watch. I wish we were on the other side of it, but got to give credit to Dame and CJ and Plumlee was. I mean, Myles Leonard was freaking. Myles Leonard looked like freaking Hakeem out there.
You can't call Myers Miles, man. He'll bark at you. He's done it to PA announcers time and time again.
Oh, I don't care if he barks at me. He talks just like Blake Griffin. They're voice doppelgangers. I don't care about that.
Voice doppelgangers. I can go with that. Now, heading into that game, the key to me was the Avery Bradley absence. How much does Avery Bradley mean to that team, both from a gameplay and game plan standpoint, and what he allows Avery Bradley or what he allows Isaiah Thomas to do on the other end?
It's funny because he's having one of those weird anomaly seasons where his net on off rating is a negative for some reason. Like the defense is better when he sits, but it's oddly enough, so is Kawhi Leonard. So
it's a weird one.
Yeah, I don't want to. It's funny because people, he's not defensively impactful like he was last year, and no, we know he's a great defender. Everyone in the league knows he's a great defender. For whatever reason, net rating is different when he's on the court. Okay, that's fine. Sure. Him being missing is a huge blow. With him and Marcus Smart, we have two of the best defensive perimeter guys in the league. And to have both of those guys to throw on Dame and CJ would have been huge. So, he lets because we all know who the bad defender in Boston is. It's Isaiah Thomas. He's not a very good defender at all, and it's because he's undersized. He dies on screens like a bug on a windshield. He's just too small. So, offensively, we were fine. It's just we couldn't stop anybody from going to the hole. And that's actually the big thing with the Boston this year, rim protection and rebounding. And it showed against Portland.
Which is kind of strange because those are the same. It's a lot of the same issues, and the two rosters are constructed a lot alike, where there's a lot of athleticism and there's a lot of scoring output in the backcourts. But there's certainly some holes to cover up. With Boston, it's a little weird because I would say that their roster makeup is a lot stronger from top to bottom than Portland's. How much of that can you attribute to integrating something like Al Horford and some of the injuries, or is it more that there's something else that's not allowing that team to fully come together?
No, I think the team's actually about what I expect. There's not a lot of size. Amir Johnson's about washed up. I love his effort, and he's fun, and everybody likes him because he tries so hard. But he's about washed up. He's been in the league since he was 18, and it's been like a 12-year vet. He's been rode hard, put up wet. Al Horford is as good as he is. I love his game. I call him the offensive lubricant. He deserves a lot of credit for Isaiah Thomas and Avery Bradley this year. Just him being on the court opened up so much for everybody else. But he's not a strong rebounder. He's just not. And the way he plays stretching the floor now, he actually puts himself out of rebounding position even more. So that's just something Boston will have to deal with in free agency or trade market. But it's been reoccurring. So I don't think it's so much indicative of any kind of problem that they can really fix internally. I had a podcast on the Truth pod with my man Nick Gelso, and his thing is coach just needs to drill into them about rebounding techniques. I think at this stage of their careers and the season, we know teams don't practice really, and so he's not going to be going back to square one rebounding drills. That's just not how it's going to work. So the Celtics either need to dig down together and decide to be better on the rebounds, put body on somebody, hit somebody when the shot goes up. I don't know if it's going to change anything, but I think we just need another big body there.
In terms of like fandom and what you do there with the Cavs, like at least for Blazer fans, but it's been such a bad season. But knowing that the Warriors are there and there's really nothing that you can do to either get to the Western Conference Finals or the Finals, but Boston's in a much better position. How are fans with that, knowing that there's probably little to no chance of ever beating the Cavs?
It's funny because both East and West are conferences in the same kind of thing, predicament. One has the Warriors, which are just built like the Death Star. And then there's Cleveland that has LeBron. LeBron's basically a cheat code by himself. You know, he's like a superhero. So both conferences know who's pretty much, I think, especially the East, we know who's going to make the finals. And at least I can't speak for other fans. I know me personally, I've just came to that realization kind of, and I've had my revelation where instead of pining for the days when we had, you know, we were a powerhouse back in 2008, 2011, that's not fair to this team. Danny Ainge is just building the best team that he possibly can. And all you want is a chance, right? Because you never know what can happen. So I'm fine with it. I mean, it is what it is, right? There's only so many superstar players to go around. We don't have one of the super duper stars. Isaiah Thomas has fashioned himself into an all-star type, star type player as far as the score. But it's just different. And it's okay. I'm okay with it because – what are you going to do? Like, look at Memphis. Memphis was great for 6-7 years, but no one ever really considered them a contender. But their fans loved them. They mean so much to the city of Memphis that it's ridiculous. So I think that's all Boston can do. You know, they have a great score. They have a high quality center, a lot of good role players. It is what it is, man. So if Ainge can swing a big deal, I'm all about it. That's what. But I think I almost feel like that ship has kind of sailed with when we pick Jaylen Brown.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting when you talk about the way that the team is built and how they're constructed right now in the season that Isaiah Thomas is having. If you look at him and Dame, their games and their mindsets are really similar. If you're picking one to build a team either for the rest of the season, a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever you want to lay it out as, which one do you take and why?
I want to be biased and say the hometown kid, say Isaiah, but I gotta be realistic. So Dame, and it's really harsh because I'm almost being a hypocrite. The big knock on Isaiah is he's undersized, and I think people look at him as a novelty instead of a great player, which he's been a great player the last couple of years actually. But if I'm picking between him and Dame because they're very similar, I think Isaiah is probably a little better mid-range shooter, while Dame is a lot, you know, bigger, stronger, get to the hole a lot better. Even though both are like in the top three or four as far as drives per game and scoring off of drives, but I'd have to go with Dame just for the size factor. You know, there is a big difference between 6'5" and 5'8", and Isaiah's making it not matter, but it matters. So if I have my choice, I'd go Dame.
See, I don't know. I want to be the homer here and take Dame, and I would. But I think the fact that we're actually having this conversation, and it's one of those things where you have to kind of stop and think. If you're being smart about it, you have to stop and think about it. Because of the season that Isaiah Thomas is putting together, it's not that he's just jacking up shots. He's the second leading scorer in the NBA, and he's shooting a good percentage. And this is a guy that he's lightning quick, but his ability to create his own shot off the bounce is what really separates him. His ability to start and stop in space. And for a guy who's, I mean, for people who don't really understand how ridiculously hard it is to get a shot off in the NBA, take, you know, 8-9 inches off somebody and their ability to create that space, that's a lot to ask of somebody, right?
I mean, it is. And the fact that he can actually not just, you know, get to the rim, but he's scoring over bigs. He can he has these great floaters and he puts it high off the glass. And it's obviously not luck because he does it over and over and over again. Like, I remember one play in particular, playing Utah, and he just motored, you know, like diagonally across the lane. And he was going so fast, he got up to that layup so quick, Rudy Gay couldn't even react. By the time Rudy got his hands up, the ball was going in. So I almost hate when people do the whole pound-for-pound thing. And, Allen Iverson is the greatest pound-for-pound scorer. That's silly because I don't want to give credit just because a guy's small. But it is a feat to watch what he does. Like, he's pulling up and hitting these shots over guys 6-8 inches taller than him. He's taking guys to the hole that are a foot and a half taller than him. And he's doing it consistently. And it every now and then it rears his head. You know, he'll go in the hole, beautiful move, and it's just, you know, the big guy just happens to block it easily because, you know, the guy's 5'8". But it's remarkable. And when people do compare his season now to Allen Iverson, Allen has never been as efficient. I'm not saying he is Allen Iverson. Anybody out there listening, don't kill me. Don't shoot the messenger. Just this season, the way he's scoring, Allen Iverson never had a season like this. You know, Allen's never been this efficient and this kind of clutch because Isaiah is actually leading the league in scoring in the fourth quarter. So it's a lot of fun, man.
We have been in, well, for the better part of a couple weeks, in full-on trade mode as Blazer fans just because it's not going well, and that's basically all we have. Any chance you see a deal between the Blazers and Celtics happening?
The only reason I say no is because it's funny. They are like bizarro images of each other. They both, you know, Plumlee's the slower, less skilled Al Horford. Dame's the bigger, stronger Isaiah. Where Avery Bradley and Smart are all defense, and you know they chip in offensively. CJ's all offense and you know little defense. He's a saloon door. So they are kind of bizarro. I don't see what they would need from each other. I'm hearing talk where I'm seeing people say, hey, maybe they should time to break up Dame and CJ. And so, hey, honestly, I'd take CJ in a heartbeat. You know, if you want Bradley and you know, some pieces to make it work, hey, we'll do it. But yeah, it's crazy to me because just last year this team overreached all expectations, and Dame and CJ led them to the playoffs against all odds, and now they're struggling, and they are. But you got these two guys locked up for the next 4 or 5 years. You don't just say, "All right, this is not working. Trade them." One good defensive center, like let's say our boy, what's his name, Azili. Azili's not hurt, and we aren't having this conversation, you know. So I don't see anything that they could move amongst each other that would really benefit both teams.
See, you and I, we've talked back and forth for a while now, and I've never thought that the Dame CJ backcourt can work out over the long haul. And I love both these guys, and anybody who knows me, who's sat down and talked to me or watched games with me, knows how much I truly love each one of these guys as individual players. But I firmly believe that in the long run, unless they get a superstar two-way player, they need a Kawhi Leonard or somebody like that that can play both ways at the small forward position, that you can't cover up for enough defensive deficiencies. Do you think that there's a way? Do you think that just a legit center, a legit defensive center that can cover pick and rolls, protect the rim, give them some offensive production and rebound, is that enough to really make it work through the long haul?
I do. I think that's really all you're missing. Because, yeah, neither one of those guys plays defense. But if you get somebody watching the back line who can clean up their mistakes and, you know, Terry Stotts could, you know, like we've seen teams without strong defenders at the guards succeed. I'm trying to think of one in my head, but I don't know. I just those two are just so good offensively. I don't think you just give up on them. Now, CJ is a great trade chip. And if I mean, you get a deal that makes sense. Of course, and the question would be, like, are you going to trade for another two guard, and what two guard are you trading for? You know what I'm saying? And then what do you do? Like, it has to be a wing, pretty much, right? You don't want to trade him for I guess you could trade him for a big man. So, but it's definitely worth it. It's interesting. It's interesting. I remember when you first brought it up to me, I thought you were nuts. But the more I think about it, it's not crazy.
What's your philosophy on tanking? Because where the Blazers are at now, eight seed is the best they're going to get, and that's just you're going to get slaughtered by the Warriors. What's your general philosophy on tanking?
Do you guys own your pick this year?
Yep, we have Portland has their pick, and then they have the Cavs pick, which is essentially a early second round.
Second round pick. No difference between the Cavs pick and the second round pick. So here's the thing. I'm pro tanking as far as the general idea behind it. I'm definitely pro tanking because, like, when we first got Isaiah Thomas, I was a little irked, and we made the playoffs. I was irked because I wanted to tank and get a great pick. Now we see what those guys are turning into, you know, in the upper side of that draft. I'm not that stressed about it, and we got Isaiah Thomas. But I don't know as far as reversing field mid season for a team like Portland. The playoff tradition is and having vets like Dame. I don't know how that flies and how you go about that. Because you're not going to sit Dame, right? You're not going to sit Dame, you know, injury free and say, all right, we're tanking. You're not, you know, players aren't complicit into the tanking when people talk about team franchises tanking. That's not, you know, hey guys, we're going to start throwing games. That's not how it works. You all know this. So I don't see how Portland does it. You know, I think they owe it to Dame. You know, like last year with Houston, sure, they made the eighth seed and, you know, it was a down season, but they could still look and say, hey, we fought and made the playoffs. We, you know, we took a game from Golden State. There's something silver lining. Now, for a really young team, tanking, it's not a big deal. And, you know, these guys but having a taste of success and then trying to take a step back, I don't think that's how it works. I don't think it's going to work.
When I look at this team and I look at the way it's currently constructed, I've called it a flawed roster a lot. because there's a lot of guys on here that aren't going to be here through the long haul. The two guys that you can say unequivocally that you know who they are, you know what their place in the franchise is, are Dame and CJ. Everybody else is up for debate. And when I look at this roster, there's a couple of young guys in Noah Vonleh and Myers Leonard. You've got money invested in Myers Leonard, and Vonleh's getting ready to come up on a contract here shortly. You're going to lose Mason Plumlee probably by at the end of the year because he's a restricted free agent, and you're already capped out.
Mm-hmm.
So
can you do me a favor real quick? Let's quick aside here. Now, I don't quite understand why they felt they had to spend all their money last offseason.
It was essentially use it or lose it.
Why would they lose it?
With the way the CBAs worked out, it was one of those things where they had to use the money or it wouldn't be available because the contracts for the other guys would be coming up and it would eat into that money. That was the only year, because of the way the roster was constructed with basically everybody coming up at the same time, that when the new contracts kicked in, they wouldn't have the availability of space. And this is why I go back and I really don't like the Nick Batum deal and trading him away, because they cleared that team out when LaMarcus left. And
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh because I already see where you're going with it, because they cleared this space when LaMarcus left and they ended up giving all these guys money and they could have paid Nick Batum.
They could have paid Nick and they could have paid Robin.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. Looking back. Yeah.
Yeah. You cleared space so you'd have cap space, and now you're capped out and you've got lesser players in those positions. And the thing is that the thing about Portland is that what people I don't think really realize is that they're the fourth youngest team in the league. The average age of that roster, their playing roster, is just over 25 years. It's just the Thunder, the Sixers, and the Timberwolves that have younger rosters. They're still a really, really young team. And they're 1 year removed from being a team that's supposed to be being rebuilt. So for me, yeah, that last year was great and all. And the experience of getting into the second round of playoffs, all that was fantastic. It was the stars kind of coming together perfectly, though. Everything right. went their
Perfect
way.
Perfect storm. Perfect storm last year, yeah.
And if you look at the way that things are going this year, you've got the draft pick. Unless things go absolutely haywire from 5, 6, and 7 in the Western Conference, there's almost no mathematical possibility of moving above the 8th seed.
I guess this is my question: How do you sell this to Dame? Right? How do you sell that as a franchise to Dame and CJ?
That's the tough part. And to me, if you know that Mason Plumlee's not coming back, why not see what you've got in Myers Leonard? And I know I'm looking at this from a totally holistic and non-real-world scenario, but if you play guys like Vonleh and Leonard, you're probably going to drop your win total. You're going to improve your odds, and you're going to be a lottery team. And, you know, every draft is loaded, yada, yada, yada. It's not until a couple years later that we know. But this draft does have a lot of high-potential players going into it, so why not get another young value piece, and I don't just mean value by the player themselves, but the contract. If you look at Portland's roster up and down, who is on a cheap deal? Al-Farouq Aminu is the only one.
And that's amazing. Remember when he first got paid? And everybody kind of tripped out and talked about how expensive it was?
Yeah, it was like, how can you pay Aminu $7.5 million a year? Now you're looking at that like, that's basically the MLE under the new CBA.
I mean
that in itself is a good deal, but This is one of those
ideas that sounds great on paper. It's mm-hmm. just it's the human element comes in, and Dame's going to see Plumlee sitting on that bench and getting 20 minutes when he should be getting 25, 30. And no, it's hard to sell that to your veterans. Hey, we're going to I don't see how they do it. You know what I mean? So, let's go back to Houston, right? It's more extreme than Houston, obviously, because Houston got that A seed. But that's my point, is that Houston 1 year got the A seed, and then sure, they signed a couple guys this offseason, but you already got those guys on your roster. You already got Allen Crabbe. You already got CJ. You already got guys, the shooters that you need. It's that one piece. Do you guys think did they know that Azili would be like this?
From my feeling, from what I've heard and kind of everything that I've kind of put together, the reason he got his deal and when he got it was because it was a mutual agreement that Azili needed a home and Portland needed to do something to mitigate some of the noise surrounding the Evan Turner signing. And when he signed the contract, the day he signed it, I called it the I failed the MRI contract. because
so they knew it, but they were like, you know what, we got to do something with this money.
We got to do something with it, and let's try and see if we can hit a home run. Because if it works out, great. If not, you can say, well, you know, it's only $7.8 million guaranteed, and the second year's an option. I mean, you're really playing with fire when you're playing with knee injuries in Portland bigs. I mean, it's never going to play well with a fan base. And they kind of oversold it heading into the season because all of a sudden he's playing in practice and now he may be ready come mid-November. And then all of a sudden we get news that he's shutting it down. Taylor and I were talking in July and I said, you know, I asked him, what's the over-under on Azealy's game played, and I'm thinking like when he gets healthy, he'll play maybe play half a season, so he'll play somewhere between 30-35 games. Taylor said the over is 20, and I just kind of laughed, like, no way. Now there's a reality that he may and probably will never play a single game in a Portland Trailblazers uniform.
What I heard the other day when they said he was like giving big hugs and everything, like he knew he wasn't coming back, or what's going on with that?
We still don't know. His agent has said that it's not. They're not having surgery, and that it's past now the time frame when the Blazers could file for a medical exemption. So unless he's being shipped out in part of a trade that's coming up down the road as part of salary cap filler, because for another team, it's incoming money that comes off their books next year for a team, let's say like Denver, that's below the salary floor. You bring him in and with somebody else, if the Blazers made a move for Nurkic, that would bring
them up. Which would be a great move for them.
I think it works out for both parties, but I think because of the rookie deal that Denver's going to overvalue him, and rightly so, because the production you're getting out of him outweighs what his actual dollar contribution is to the salary cap and to the team, which for sure. To me is exactly the guys that Portland needs to go after. They need to restock the cupboard. They don't have any of those guys that are the question that I ask people when it comes to Portland's roster and the way the salaries are currently constructed, who is currently overperforming or outperforming their expected value commensurate to their salary?
I guess because Aminu's so cheap, Aminu.
But that's it, right? Dame is a superstar. He's getting paid like a superstar. You could say CJ because technically he's still on his rookie deal this year, but he's going to be making more than Dame next year because of the way the contracts roll out.
Well, technically, yes. Technically, CJ. But right now, obviously. But we know he's getting paid. So, yeah, man. The Evan Turner deal is what really just blew my mind with you guys. And I remember once all the deals were rolled out with Portland, I remember just listing all the guys and realizing that you were at the cap with like six guys already. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just blew my mind. But, you know, other people kept saying, no, it makes sense. It makes sense. And I get it. Like you said, the money wouldn't have been there and all that. But, I mean, sooner or later, you got to say, I'm not paying this guy that. You know? And especially, like, I think I would have been okay with almost everything else. Evan Turner. Turner. And Alan Crabb might have to just walk. I couldn't see giving Crabb $20 million.
Yeah, no way. You watched Evan Turner obviously a lot last year. How would you? Brad Stevens used him really, really well, and it's still Stotts still hasn't found a way to use him better lately. But with CJ and Damian, how would you use Turner with CJ and Dame?
He'd give them Gatorade. He'd go fetch burritos. he'd be the towel guy. You know, I don't like him at all. And even in Boston, I think he was a net negative his whole time there. And his game is just. This is what I love about Brad Stevens. He made it work, right? It's like when somebody has a shaky table and you use a matchbook and fold over a couple of times. He made it work. He made something that worked. I mean, and that's what you want Evan Turner to do is handle the ball. But again, Dame and CJ are so deadly with the ball in their hands. Sure, they can play off of Evan Turner, but they don't need to. You know what I mean? That was the whole goal, have him run the second unit or have him run and let those guys, you know, play off of him. But, I mean, he's not that good that you want that. You know what I mean? I never understood that. And bless you guys' heart for having to deal with him for the next, what, 5 years, 4 years? So.
All right. When you look at the Northwest Division, you've got Oklahoma City, you've got Utah, you've got Portland, Minnesota. When you look at these guys, which team do you think has the brightest future going forward over the next year, 2 years, 3 years? Again, however you kind of want to break it down.
I can't say Portland. I kind of want to say Portland, but I mean, I just the contracts, man.
Isn't that a little weird though? Where were we a year ago? Portland is an up and coming team. Everything's going their way. Now you look at it, Oklahoma City's a better team than they are right now. Utah is a better team than they are right now. And how far behind are Minnesota and Denver? And are they
Minnesota
behind?
And Denver are hot on their heels. And Utah, I think, for the immediate future, it's going to be Utah. It's going to be Utah because they're built to win now, and they're still young enough to have next next 2 or 3 years. We're talking 4 or 5 years as constructed. They have some decisions to make with Gordon Hayward and big Derek Favors. But the Nuggets definitely have the Nuggets are everything that Orlando thought it was a couple years ago or last year, because they have so much young talent that can really play and on great contracts, rookie deals, whatever. Wilson Chandler and Gallo have great contracts. The Nuggets have the world in their palm right now. Minnesota is on the cusp of doing something really good. I don't know if Tibbs is the right coach. But, yeah, man, the Thunder even having Russell Westbrook locked up and then having, like you said, one of the three or four youngest rosters aren't a really good place. Even though they just locked up Adams and Depot, and I don't know, and Cantor's money, I don't know really how many assets they have to move. So if we're talking in order, we're talking especially long term, it'd be like Denver, Minnesota, I'm sorry, Utah for the immediate future, and then Portland's not a top, top three or four, and we're talking about, looking for the future. Yeah. I hate to say it, but see, I almost hate to say it because this summer I was saying, I thought Portland would struggle to make the playoffs. I've been wrong about a lot of things. This is one thing I was kind of right about. I just, from looking at the roster construction and because Evan Turner's not good. I said last year, it was a perfect storm and they might struggle this year. They might struggle this year. And I didn't think they'd struggle like they're struggling now, but I mean, but again, if they could somehow find a way to get a young, springy rim protector in there, I think it changes the dynamic a lot and things look a lot better.
So basically, if Portland is willing to give up Crab and, let's say, a Cavs first-round pick and the Sixers bite and send Noel to Portland, you think that helps clear up some things?
That would be ideal. That would be absolutely ideal. Nerlens Noel and pick and rolls with Dame. So you said give up Crab and who else?
Crab in the Cavs first round pick.
I mean, and you know what? That actually would. And you give Philly one of the wing that it desperately needs, long athletic wing who can shoot. Which I know Covington is long athletic. He really can't. He's not this season. He really can't shoot. But
he can knock down threes. But Crab, I mean, people talk about his struggles, and his quote unquote struggles are he's 40% from three and 50% from mid range. So.
You know what? If you've been floating that deal around, let's try to talk to some front offices because that makes a lot of sense for both teams.
It's one of those deals that makes so much sense to me, at least, for both sides. It's the exact reason why it won't get done.
It makes too much sense.
It's one of those things where it's a position of need for both. The Sixers have the ability to take on the salary because they have so much space. They have a logjam in the front court. Portland can then get a younger piece. It's going to cost them because he's a restricted free agent going into next year. But you're freeing up Alan Crabb's cap space to basically become Nerlens Noel's cap hold.
How much do you think he's going to get paid?
I figure he's going to get Crabb money between 15 and 17 because he's still so young.
I think he's actually – yeah, I think – what's his max?
I'd have to take a look at the way the new CBAs go, but I think his max would hit – I think 19 or 20, but
he probably will get that, that's all right. Like you said, if they're giving up Crab, they're moving Crab and they're going to pay it. That's all right. Yeah. So
you're basically just sliding the money from having, literally $100 million invested in your backcourt into some of that money being in your front court.
Okay. Yeah. I'm aboard. Most times when I hear a trade offers from people, manufactured trade that sounds like a bunch of bogus, I'm like, all right, one side would hate that, but that makes sense for both sides.
It's like I said, it's one of those things where, it fits so well that it probably won't happen. But let's talk a little bit broader NBA here. And I know you were watching the Warriors game earlier. Where do you sit on KD going to Golden State? Just kind of the whole global view of it. Were you with it? Were you against it? Do you think it's good for the league?
I don't think it's good for the league. Okay, I'm not going to – that whole good or bad for the league thing, I don't like speaking in absolutes like that. I know when it first went down, I was disappointed in Kevin Durant. I wasn't upset with him. I didn't think it was a bad move. Hey, you know, that's what free agency he's free to choose what he wants to do. I was disappointed in him because they were just minutes away from going to the finals as with OKC. But the further we get away from it, I'm looking at it, and obviously he wasn't really happy in OKC. Or even if he wasn't, even when he wasn't unhappy, he realized or felt that they had gone as far as they were going to go. He'd given 9 years of his life to this franchise. You know, I read the Rolling Stones article about him, and, you know, it makes sense. He's like, I'm a different player now. I've always been doing everything for everyone else. Now, I mean, they paid you handsomely to do it, so don't boo-hoo poor me. But at the same time, I mean, we really can't knock him. We want to see the best against the best. We want to see the players that we elevate as far as the elite players. We want to see them struggle and earn their stripes. But, I mean, at the same time, if you can get a job getting paid the same or more, you know, having to do less with better talent around you, would you do it? Of course you would.
And I think that's when you take a step back and you take the names away from it, I think that's the big takeaway is that a lot of people want to say, you know what, I have my own team. I'm going to run it. I'm going to do it my way. But – And then the other argument is, well, he took the easy way out. Is it easy? Because he's still got to go through the Cavs.
Yeah, and that's my thing. It's like, it's defined easy, right? Because it's still the NBA. And every night, as we see, they're getting the other team's best shot. Every night, and now the pressure is different. All the expectations are different. Before it was, hey, OKC was a contender, but they're, you know, they could almost do no wrong. And sure, the pressure was on his back. But it was still, you know, you're in a mix of a bunch of contenders. Now the bullseye is on his back. And if they don't win two or three championships over the next couple of years, it's a failure. You know, I mean, that's just how it is. It's a whole different amount of pressure, a whole different kind of pressure now. So it's not easier. But I remember reading about it when it all first went down. And I think Jim O'Brien, you know, of Team USA or something, was, you know, he made a quote where he's like, Kevin Durant wants to be one of the guys. And he's going somewhere where he can fit in. And that just kind of, I don't think less of Kevin Durant. It just shifts my perception to him. You know what I mean? And it's not. It's probably on me. It's not fair of me to say that because we just want our franchise players to, you know, to take that pressure. We want them to want that pressure. We want them to know this is my team. And he wants to be one of the guys. So is that a bad thing? No, it's not. He's playing amazing, and he's an MVP consideration because he's been incredible. It just changed. So I think in the long run, and it's fascinating to watch them, you know, relatively struggle. Like the loss of Miami tonight, they don't hold leads very well sometimes, even though the time to blow you out by 40. They size can really bother them now. Or 45, right? size can really bother them at times now. And, you know, I feel like teams aren't scared of them like they were last year. Last year was a kind of shock and awe thing. I think teams are over that now and realize if we keep coming at these guys, we can have a shot. They're better than us, but we can have a shot. So it's interesting. It's all fun to watch. I like it.
All right, James, that's all we got for your day. Go ahead and give us your plugs.
So, it's not at James Holas, Dan. It's find me on Twitter at J Holas. It's H-O-L-A-S, at J Holas Hoops. I'm over at B-Ball Breakdown where we're pumping out good content. I actually run the Away Team podcast for PressBasketball.com and the Truth podcast over at ABPN, the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. So, I'm just trying to talk basketball, write basketball. Check me out.
Everybody, make sure you check him out. Follow him on Twitter. He's a good follow. Make sure you troll him a little bit. He loves it.
Oh, my. Dan, see, this is why you're going to get blocked and spammed.
All right, James, man. We appreciate having you on, man. And, of course, we'd like to thank James Holas for joining us. It's always great to have another viewpoint, another guy from the outside taking a look at what's going on in Portland and giving another perspective from somebody who's not immersed in the red and black every day. So we want to kind of shift gears and go back to something we talked about earlier in the podcast, and that's the play of Myers Leonard. Now, for those that don't know, the reason I'm laughing right now is I'm not only a member, but I'm also the president of the Myers Leonard Fan Club. When Taylor and I first started working together, I did a piece on him kind of outlining how his game could and would evolve, and people called me crazy when I said that, no, the guy really can shoot. No, the guy really can defend the paint. And people were like, oh, well, he only does this, that, and the other. And I'm like, he's still young. Still a young kid. And he is. He's still a young kid. bigs take a long, long time to develop in the league. And the thing about Myers Leonard is, when he's in the right frame of mind, he is a truly, truly dynamic player in today's NBA. You see his line, Taylor, from Boston. It wasn't just the threes and the dunks. It was the emotion, the mindset, the mentality on the floor. When he had that first dunk, that entire Blazers bench, everybody on the floor, everybody in Boston was oohing and awing because of the ferocity. It reminded me of the night before when Joel Embiid went running down the paint and dunked on the entire team's soul. What that can do to a team and for a team is huge.
Well, this is the conversation surrounding Myers that we had. And when I said winning and losing isn't as important to me as watching guys develop and seeing what you have in certain guys. And that's just the way that the first half of the season has shaken out. And the best the Blazers can do mathematically is probably the 8 seed. So I'd like to see guys like Myers get a full run and get 25 to 30 minutes and say, all right, let's see what you can do with those minutes. Because every time you think Myers is going to get a chance, he got hurt last year. There are teams that are bad matchups for him if teams are going to go small. Plumlee's probably better situated to play the five more so than Myers is if teams go small. But I'm at the point with Myers where I know, and I think everybody else does, that it's mental with him. He's got all the physical tools to be effective. He's got all the physical tools to do what he did against Boston. It's a mental thing with him. There are guys that don't have the physical tools, and you just know it's not going to turn out. Nick Batum was the same way. It's like it was all mental with those guys. So guys where it's all in their head are really, really tough. Because you never know if they're going to be able to sustain it. You see glimpses of it when they have their confidence going, but I just have a hard time judging guys where it's mental. I don't know what to do with them.
Yeah, and this is why I constantly go back to your point here, and that give him minutes, see what he gives you. In that, it's kind of like a make or break time period for him. Either he's going to be a journeyman big who can come on the floor and knock down some threes and be a Spencer Hawes type for you, or he's going to be a legit NBA starter. That doesn't mean he needs to be an all-star, but if he's a 37-38% three-point shooter, gives you solid here's the thing. Rebounding doesn't necessarily mean rebounding totals. Robin Lopez did not put up massive rebounding numbers, but because he was so big, he ate up space and allowed other guys to gobble up rebounds. Myers Leonard is easily the best box out big on this roster. He's also the best screen setter on this team. He has the frame, the body, the mindset, the mentality when engaged to do all those things better and more effectively than any single person on this roster.
So how do you build his confidence?
You get him plays like you got him in Boston. And you heard, if you watch the game, if you watch any of the postgame or any of the pregame coverage, Coach Stotts went to Myers before the game, shoot the ball, big fella.
And that's what they need. I mean, they need it from their teammates, too. But even fans last year, when Myers is passing around the perimeter, and he's got an open shot, and he passes it up, all fans, when you're at games, will yell, and if you're watching at home at your TV, shoot the ball. People want him to shoot.
The oohs and the ahs.
Like, when Al Farouk cocks back, I go, please, whatever you do, do not shoot. When Myers gets the ball and he's wide open, shoot the ball. All of his teammates want him to shoot it. All of fans want him to shoot it. It's okay if you miss. If you're wide open, you're a good enough shooter to take it. So it's a confidence-building thing, but he just has to get sustained minutes. This happened, last year. He had a great game, I want to say, against the Jazz.
He had the Kings game against Cousins where he shut him down and shot well.
Yeah, no, he didn't play against the Jazz. He had one game, though, where he played really, really well, and then he didn't play against the Jazz and he didn't play against the Warriors. I'm talking last season. Because I remember doing that show, and I'll have to go back and find the exact numbers. But basically, he had a great game, and then he didn't play the next two.
He's getting DMPs after falling out.
That's a tough spot for him. And it was between him and Harkless last year, and it all depends on lineups and situations. And I understand Stotts has to put out the best lineup that he thinks. That's another thing we could talk about at some point, changing the starting lineup around. But that's figuring out a spot for Myers. I would rather get him 25 to 30 minutes a game and say, to hell with the matchups. we're going to see what we have in Myers much more than I would trying to match up with another team. Yet you have to see what you have with a confident Myers. And if you give him those minutes and he's not confident and he's still not shooting the ball and he's still not performing, at that point you can go, okay, I feel like we're pretty confident in what we have or don't have.
And then that's the situation that I find myself in. And I think a lot of people, whether you're pro or anti, like however you want to look at it, when it comes to Myers-Leonard game. And for me, I've made no bones about it in that where I see this team going, I don't want them to get that eighth playoff seed. I don't want them to have it. I don't think it does them any good. Sure, from a marketing standpoint and from a ticket sales standpoint and the additional revenue that two home games is going to give you, I understand the business side and the player personnel side of things. From a purely holistic standpoint, this is what we were talking about with James, is that I think it would be a better idea and a better opportunity for the Blazers to take hold of here in that you see what you have from Myers, you see what you have from Vonleh, and you let the chips fall where they lay. And to me, if Portland loses a few games in that, so be it. If you get to see what you have in Leonard, what you have in Vonleh, and you don't make the playoffs, well, guess what? Now you're in the lottery. And you get another draft pick in there. You get to restock. I mean, to me, I don't see a scenario where this isn't it's not a win-win, but there's no loss in there, so to speak, for the short or the long term.
No, there's no loss in seeing what you have in Myers, which is crazy to think about this point of his career. We're having a conversation of see what you have. But a lot of that is because, well, he was hurt last year a little bit, but he just hasn't had consistent enough minutes. And that's when you really know what you have in a guy, and he hasn't. He hasn't gotten consistent enough minutes. And so when you see what he does against Boston, you know it's in there. Now it's up to the Blazers to see if they could bring it out in him. I also don't believe, looking at the landscape of the NBA, that Myers is going to be tradable. Maybe. But
that's the thing is that his production throughout the year has kind of vacillated with his playing time. And early in the season, he couldn't shoot. And I firmly believe that his shoulder still wasn't right. Anybody who's known anybody...
He got back quick.
That's the thing. He came back. I didn't think he'd be back until about 3-4 weeks ago.
He pushed his rehab pretty hard.
And anybody who knows anybody or anybody who's ever had shoulder surgery knows that the strength, the recovery, the motion, everything that goes on with that whole system of your body is a very, very long, tough, arduous process. So from there, it's a difficult thing to see how it progresses. And with Myers, you look at his field goal, his three-point percentage. It was 20% in October. It's 40% now. It's progressed every single month. So when you see that kind of growth, I think you have to give him that opportunity. So we'll see over these next couple home games kind of where this all ends up and how it goes out. But to me, that's what needs to happen over the remainder of the season.
I hope it does, and I hope you see production from him. I hope you see his teammates get him involved. They need a third or fourth option. Well, they need both. They need a third option, and they need a fourth option on this team.
Fourth, fifth, sixth.
It's rotating guys. It's Crabb. It's Turner one night. It's Myers maybe one night. If Myers can solidify himself as a guy who you could count on to get 10 to 12 points, that'd be so big for this team to have somebody that you can count on, because right now they don't.
Yeah, and I think we talked about how Harkless could end up being that third guy coming into the season as early season performance. He's kind of tailed off a bit so much that he's not going to find himself in the starting lineup, you know, and with the way Stotts has kind of shifted things around. And in the next episode, which we'll be recording here tomorrow with the illustrious Ben Gulliver, formerly of Blazers Edge, now of Sports Illustrated, and Beaverton, Portland area native, we'll be able to dive into that a little bit more and get his thoughts on what's happening in Portland and do you see these roster changes, well, not roster changes, but rotation changes playing out in the short term, long term, or is this kind of a gimmick that Stotts is playing with? Anything else from you, Taylor?
No, man. That's fantastic.
All right. Well, guys, thanks for listening.
Pat myself on the back.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe I can knock over another glass. But as always, for Taylor Danforth, I'm Dan Morang. This is Trailing Blazers. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio. Make sure to follow us on iTunes.
We're like, everywhere, people.
Leave reviews. Follow us on Facebook, on Twitter. We're literally going everywhere and anywhere. Once again, thank you and have a great day.